Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A staggering 100 million people have now been forced to flee their homes globally, the UN Refugee Agency UNHCR said on Thursday. Worldwide food insecurity, the climate crisis, war in Ukraine and other emergencies from Africa to Afghanistan are leading causes of this dramatic milestone, the agency said in a new report. In Geneva, head of the UN agency Filippo Grandi explained that every year of the last decade the numbers have climbed. He said that he could not imagine how the trend can change as the global food insecurity and energy crisis continues.
If you have a food crisis on top of everything that I have described, right? War, human rights, climate, you name it. On top of that, you have a food crisis. It will just accelerate the trends that are described in this report and that we have seen accelerating already in the first few months of the year.
Data from UNHCR also underscored the crucial role played by the world's developing nations in sheltering displaced people, with low- and middle-income nations hosting more than 4 in 5 of the world's refugees. A UN-partnered bid to curb the use of explosive weapons in towns and cities took a significant step forward on Thursday as member states prepared to gather in Geneva to examine new guidelines. The development has been driven by the recognition that civilians are at increased risk from armed conflicts that have become more protracted, complex and urbanized. The weapons that continue to be used in urban settings are totally unsuited to heavily built-up areas, said Dominique Gosseur from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or OCHA.
Today, some 50 million people are estimated to be living in situations of urban conflict or at the threat of urban conflict and are exposed to the acute risks and dangers posed by these weapons. So the political declaration tomorrow that will be presented by Ireland, that has been stewarding this process for the last 3 years, is going to be a key step to step up the protection of civilians.
Last year, more than 1,200 incidents involving the use of explosive weapons in populated areas were recorded in 21 states, causing the death or injury of over 10,000 people. Nearly 90% of the victims were civilians, highlighting the need for updated international norms on the use of these weapons. The political declaration on strengthening the protection of civilians from the humanitarian consequences arising from the use of explosive weapons in populated areas is to be presented to member states at the UN in Geneva on Friday. A formal signing ceremony is expected later in the year. Domestic workers make an important contribution to society, but about half of them receive no welfare benefits at all, the UN labour agency ILO said on Thursday. Even worse, latest data from the International Labour Organization shows that just 6% of the world's 75.6 million domestic workers qualify for comprehensive welfare benefits. This is despite the fact that these key workers provide vital care for families and households, ILO explained, citing data that shows that well over 9 in 10 domestic workers lack access to benefits that many of us take for granted, from medical care to sickness and unemployment assistance, old age pensions and invalidity support. In a call for more countries to make social security a reality for domestic workers, ILO said that extending welfare coverage to them has not kept up with legal requirements because the vast majority are employed informally. Women are particularly vulnerable as they make up more than 3 in 4 of the domestic workforce. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Do we stop ourselves sleepwalking into another Great Depression? It's breathtaking. You know, for folks that are listening to this, I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps, and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/taxcast. See you there.
That will be in the, you can join Naomi Fowler in the latest tax cast from the Tax Justice Network in the second hour after the latest headlines from Democracy Now. Right now, coming up is Law and Disorder.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we celebrate Pride Month, and we'll look at Don't Say Gay laws in Florida and other states.
We will speak today with attorney Michael Como, who works against these regressive laws. We also speak today with Professor Rashid Khalidi about the recent assassination of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh.
He puts it in the context of Israel as a colonial settler state. Rashid Khalidi is the great historian in the area.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
Progressive attorney Chesa Boudin was elected 2.5 years ago by the people of San Francisco to be their district attorney. He fulfilled his campaign promises by enacting programs and policies that would take on the phenomena of mass incarceration. The United States holds more people in prison, 2.3 million, and more people in the criminal legal system, 6 million on probation or parole, than any other country in the world. Chesa enacted the policies he advocated when he ran. He eliminated cash bail, which favors the rich, and his office exonerated innocent people. He prosecuted white-collar criminals and brutal cops. He tried juveniles as juveniles, not adults. He set up diversion programs, and as much as 2/3 of the people arrested in San Francisco are either drug addicts or mentally ill or both. He used the money saved to support victims of crimes. But the ruling rich in our country have only one answer to the social problems we have. Lock them up. Mass incarceration was their answer to the civil rights movement 50 years ago, and it's still their answer today, as demonstrated by the campaign they mounted to get rid of Chesa Boudin. They spent $6 million doing it, outspending Chesa's supporters 6-1. High-tech billionaires, real estate magnates, and the police union were the forces behind Chesa's defeat. How did they do it? They used fear. When former President Richard Nixon, a native Californian, was asked at the end of his career what was his secret of success, he answered immediately that it was fear. Fear, adding that they don't teach you that in the Boy Scouts. The forces in San Francisco aligned against Chesa used fear and lies. They lied about the true nature of crime in San Francisco, which is in fact had gone down in most areas since Chesa took office. They used their money to spread lies through a vast media campaign after first hiring signature gatherers to get the recall on the ballot. Interviews after the election indicated the issues for voters really wasn't even so much crime. They talked about homelessness, the mentally deranged, people defecating in the streets. In some ways, the recall was almost a referendum on the deteriorating condition of life in San Francisco, as everywhere. As a progressive prosecutor, Chesa was the most prominent of a number of prosecutors across the country elected by people who want criminal justice reform. That is why he was targeted nationwide. Progressive prosecutors throughout the United States are facing a backlash. There are threats to recall George Gascon in Los Angeles. As of this broadcast, Tori Verber Salazar is losing her election in the San Joaquin County, California, and Alvin Bragg in Manhattan will likely face a challenge as well. Is there a victory in Chess's defeat? Certainly. He showed the way by his policies, which reformed the San Francisco criminal legal system. Although he was defeated, Chess showed us what needs to be done. He put together a team of reformers who have their work cut out for them. Chess Boudin, presente.
This April, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law the Parental Rights in Education Bill. It's also known as the Don't Say Gay Law. The bill bans instruction or classroom discussion about LGBTQ issues in kindergarten through third grade. Older students may discuss gay and transgender issues if they are, quote, age-appropriate or developmentally appropriate. Florida legislators believe that classroom education about sexual orientation and gender should not start at an early age, and that parents can have the final say about what their children learn and when they learn it. Sex education has already been banned in Florida and many other states until the fifth grade. Critics of the new law contend that it focuses on a problem that does not exist for the state's youngest students. By limiting discussions about LGBTQ issues, they say, it could stifle conversations for children who need to process their own gender or sexual identity questions. Many school librarians have accused their schools of removing race and LGBTQ-related books from their shelves to avoid a fight. The Washington Post reported that schools with small budgets can't afford to contest court challenges that the law is sure to bring. Some schools are reportedly peeling off rainbow safe space stickers from their windows. And as with other restrictive laws, the chilling effect is already being seen in schools nationwide. Joining us today is K&L Gates attorney Michael Como, a triple alumnus of George Washington University. Michael is well known for his work on behalf of the LGBTQ community. He's been recognized at the local, state, and federal level with accolades including Pittsburgh Magazine's 2021 40 Under 40 honorees and City and State PA's 2022 Pride Power 100 honorees. Michael co-founded the LGBTQIA plus anti-human trafficking initiative with the FBI. He started the Pride Night series for Pittsburgh's professional sports team and serves as the chair of the LGBT Rights Committee of the Allegheny County Bar Association. We are especially glad to welcome Michael during the month of June, which our listeners know marks LGBT Pride Month nationwide. Michael Como, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
As we celebrate Pride Month, laws like Florida's Don't Say Gay are limiting what students can learn about LGBTQ issues. What exactly does this law prohibit?
Well, this particular anti-LGBTQ piece of legislation, HB 1557, it states, classroom instruction by school personnel or third parties on sexual orientation or gender identity may not occur in kindergarten through grade 3 or in a manner that is not age-appropriate or developmentally appropriate for students in accordance with state standards. What it is essentially doing, really, it's trying to silence and erase LGBTQ people, voices, and allies of LGBTQ people, specifically targeting LGBTQ issues for youth.
What are the practical effects of this law in Florida and in other states?
The Trevor Project is a really wonderful organization, and it provides crisis support for LGBTQ youth. And the Trevor Project has done studies on the impact of this type of anti-LGBTQ hatred. I believe the Trevor Project released a study last year that showed half of LGBTQ youth either seriously considered and or attempted suicide. What we're seeing is a mental health crisis as the result of this anti-LGBTQ legislation. This is not just happening in Florida. I believe the Human Rights Campaign released a statistic earlier this year that 8 states have passed anti-LGBTQ laws in 2022, and 28 states have introduced these types of anti-LGBTQ laws. We're seeing these across the nation. We're seeing governors, elected officials, and leaders, certain ones who are trying to silence and erase history, LGBTQ people from public spaces, school. And of course, this isn't just impacting the LGBT community. This is impacting other people as well. Of course, as we saw in Texas earlier this year with Texas's anti-LGBTQ law, it's not just affecting the members of the community. It's stipulating that doctors, nurses, teachers are legally required to report to parents about specific LGBTQ concerns or issues that are raised once they find out that someone is LGBTQ. So it's essentially outing kids and really putting kids at risk, both physical and mental health risk.
Michael, talk a bit, if you will, about some of the language in the bill. For example, grooming. And how does the law treat those who oppose it?
So when we talk about grooming, we're talking about a term that is associated with child sexual abuse. It refers to adults who are trying to make sex between adults and children consensual. It's outrageous that some of the proponents of the bill have publicized this campaign as an anti-grooming bill. I believe it was Governor DeSantis' press secretary, Christina Pushout, who said something to the effect of, if you're against this anti-grooming bill, which of course we know it's not, you are probably a groomer, or at least you don't denounce grooming of 4 to 8-year-old children. It's outrageous. It's not based in any science. Mental health experts, psychology experts, child development experts say that there is absolutely no evidence to show any exposure to children once they are taught about LGBTQ people or LGBTQ issues. There is no data whatsoever to show that children are being, quote, groomed if they're educated about LGBTQ issues.
Outrageous. Michael, if parents don't like certain school teachings, what recourse do they have under this bill?
So under the law, parents can actually sue the school district if they believe that the school is in violation. So the legislation goes through the procedure of how a parent files a complaint, how the school district has to respond, appoint an administrator to try to resolve the issue. And then the legislation goes on to show that if the issue is not resolved to a satisfactory level by the State Board of Education, the parents can receive monetary damages as well as attorney's fees for people who violate this anti-LGBTQ law.
Michael, you referenced incidents of suicide attempts. Can you talk about what happens when students seek or receive mental health services at their schools? What kind of privacy protections do they have?
You know, for me, it was when I saw Will and Grace premiere in 1998. I identified with Will Truman, of course, portrayed by Eric McCormick, as the gay lawyer on the show, right? I was born a lawyer, but I wasn't really aware of what the word gay meant because I had never met an out person. So at a very young age, I was 9 years old when the show premiered, and I was able to identify myself as a future gay lawyer. And of course, for trans kids, I think the science is overwhelming that trans kids are able to identify themselves as trans even before some LGB kids are able to identify as lesbian, gay, or bisexual. So what does that mean? So if I'm a trans kid or I'm an LGB kid and I'm talking to a therapist at school or anyone who works in mental health services at school, if anything is raised essentially in any way, shape, or form, the school is required to notify the parents. We've seen this in Florida. We've seen this in Texas. There is a direct result of increased mental distress for LGBTQ students just being themselves, let alone having this issue raised to their parents. So it raises very serious privacy concerns for LGBTQ students who might be struggling with their identity and for perhaps very legitimate reasons might not be out at school or out to their family. So it's really highlighting an issue that the Trevor Project has talked about and worked extensively to combat, as well as several other organizations who are closely monitoring this type of anti-LGBTQ hatred.
So why has this bill drawn so much controversy?
This bill, along with other pieces of legislation, are covertly masquerading as parents' rights bills, but what they really are anti-LGBTQ bills. I believe that over 200 pieces of LGBTQ legislation have been introduced this year. At what stage they're at varies depending on the city, the county, the state. This bill is emboldening other anti-LGBTQ advocates to introduce and try to pass their legislation. And not only is it doing what the bill is targeting, which is anti-LGBTQ efforts at youth and school, it's also affecting grades beyond the alleged kindergarten to third grade stipulation in the legislation. Of course, we saw in the news in Florida, there have been several students, valedictorians, class presidents, graduation speakers who are either being threatened to be censored in their graduation speeches if they speak out against it, which of course is a First Right Amendment violation. It doesn't take a lawyer to identify that violation.
Michael, I feel so out of touch with certain aspects of American life right now because I cannot imagine seeing something like that happen. Speaking of those who oppose this law and similar laws, the Disney company in Florida publicly came out against it. What happened to them and others who, large companies, for example, who oppose it?
Yeah, so there's actually a list. I believe the Human Rights Campaign and I believe another organization, the Americans, Freedom for All Americans, I believe they created a list. And that includes hundreds and hundreds of companies who have come out against this legislation. Of course, you cited Disney, one of the most prominent companies in Florida. They've publicly opposed the legislation. They have committed to donating to pro-LGBTQ candidates and efforts to repeal the legislation. But what we're seeing, of course, not only great efforts to combat this legislation, but we're also seeing backlash against places like Disney who are speaking out against this. It happened 45 years ago when Anita Bryant was running her alleged Save Our Children campaign. There is this backlash, and unfortunately, it's not uncommon with the marriage equality decision the Supreme Court handed out in 2015 and with the Bostock decision, the Title VII case, that the Supreme Court handed out in 2020. The Supreme Court has affirmed LGBTQ rights again and again, both under Democratic and Republican presidents and administrations. So I'll say you're seeing some temporary backlash against some pro-equality organizations, but on the other side of that coin, I actually think you're seeing more praise for those corporations that are saying, this is not a political issue, this is a civil rights issue. The Supreme Court has already addressed this. We have in the Bostock decision in 2020, the Supreme Court has repeatedly affirmed the rights of LGBTQ Americans. So I think you're seeing more people find the legislation outrageous. And I think what this group of anti-equality advocates is doing, I think they're actually uniting members of the LGBT community and allies.
We are speaking with attorney Michael Como about Florida's Don't Say Gay law and other anti-LGBTQ legislation. Michael, hopefully the Supreme Court will not overturn the right to abortion, but it looks like they may be headed in that direction, and many people fear that LGBTQ rights are next on the chopping block, but the organizing you talk about hopefully will prevent that. What about teachers who refuse to abide by the law?
There is language in the legislation that parents can bring an action against the school district. And so for teachers who are refusing to abide by the law, well, first of all, we've already seen teachers interviewed. They say that there's a chilling effect. They're very concerned about it. They're concerned about their jobs. But what Florida is trying to do has already been addressed by the Supreme Court 2 years ago. The Bostock decision was a 6-3 decision the Supreme Court handed down fittingly during Pride Month 2 years ago this June 15th. Part of the Bostock decision stated, quote, an employer who fires an individual merely for being gay or transgender violates Title VII, end quote. So the Supreme Court has already codified these rights. So Florida cannot fire a teacher for being LGBTQ. What Florida is trying to do is masquerade this legislation, as I mentioned earlier, as some sort of save the children, pro-parental rights piece of legislation, and they're trying to sort of backdoor freeze the discussion on these issues that are affecting both LGBTQ people and allies. I would say as an attorney, it's very clear that the Supreme Court has already addressed this issue. So I would teachers are protected under the Constitution, under this Supreme Court decision. So I hope that that gives them some solace as they're trying to navigate what I can only imagine is an extremely difficult and unfair position to be in.
Just to confirm, you touched on this briefly, but I assume that gay rights organizations in Florida have really marshaled response to this bill, because you've mentioned, you know, enormous support against it. Are there many gay rights organizations in that state?
There are. So a couple of the prominent ones. So one of them is Equality Florida. Of course, 6 years ago when the horrific Pulse shooting happened in Orlando, Florida, at the nightclub Pulse, when 49 LGBTQ people and allies were murdered, 6 years ago, Equality Florida was one of the organizations that led the fundraising and relief efforts for the victims and the families of the survivors and the families of the victims who were murdered. So Equality Florida is a really terrific organization that has been addressing LGBTQ issues in the state of Florida. They're led by a great executive director. They're the largest organization in Florida. They've already filed suit. The Family Equality Organization has filed suit. The National Center for Lesbian Rights has filed suit, as well as several other entities and families within the state of Florida. And all of these organizations are part of a bipartisan coalition to secure non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people throughout the state of Florida. And of course, within those organizations, I know the Human Rights Campaign is one of them that I mentioned earlier that are not only working with organizations filing suit to overturn the legislation, but also published that list of hundreds of companies that have come out to support repeal efforts of this anti-LGBTQ legislation.
You touched on this, but how does the Don't Say Gay law deal with the parental rights debate?
Yeah, it's really masquerading as this sort of parental rights opportunity. 44 years ago, Harvey Milk and other advocates in California defeated Proposition 6, which was also known as the Briggs Initiative. And this was a ballot measure that was spearheaded by State Representative John Briggs, and it would have mandated the firing of not only any California teacher who was gay, but anybody who supported gay rights. So this is, we're talking 4 to 5 decades ago, this happened, this was defeated. Unfortunately, this piece of legislation passed in Florida. So when I see pieces of legislation that bring up this parental rights debate, it's not really a parental rights debate. It's a debate about whether LGBTQ people have the same rights and whether allies have those same rights as well. And of course, the answer is yes.
Good point. And we see that in a lot of other political maneuvers. Another recently passed Florida bill would forbid instruction that maintains that certain races or sexes are privileged or oppressed. And language in that bill says it would prohibit public schools and private businesses from making people feel, quote, guilt, anguish, or other forms of psychological distress based on their race, sex, or national origin. How do you see this possibly playing out?
What these efforts are really trying to do, they're either trying to erase people who are different, or they're trying to rewrite history. So what's next? Are people going to try to advocate the ban of the history of the civil rights movement? The Supreme Court has already spoken on this. In 2015, this was codified that sexual orientation and gender identity, both of those are immutable characteristics, as is race. These are not choices that people make. These are not aspects of someone that one chooses or that one can control. And further, any efforts to try to change that, the mental health and psychological communities are in agreement that it would be so detrimental to even try to change something, let alone, of course, we know that we can't do that. So I think what it does is it puts other civil rights issues, again, on the chopping block, and I think people are understandably and justifiably concerned that if we take away civil rights in one area, what's next?
Yes, indeed. Are all these laws really a form of white supremacy, in your opinion?
It's tough to know the motivation. What it looks like is they're trying to erase anybody who's different. They're trying to silence anybody who's different. They're trying to remove discussions, issues, civil rights, and opportunities that further enhancements for people who are different. So to me, as a lawyer, we say the evidence speaks for itself. This legislation is clearly anti-equality, so I can't imagine the intention is noble. The intention appears to me to be nefarious.
We wanted to talk to you about your work related to human trafficking, but we'll have to save that for another visit with you. As we end this segment, though, what advice do you have for listeners who want to get involved in this issue?
People that can get involved in a variety of ways. They can run for local school board. They can vote in their primary election and in the general election for pro-LGBTQ candidates. They can support organizations such as the LGBTQ Victory Fund, which supports out LGBTQ candidates running for office. They can contact their state legislators. They can contact anybody in their school district. They can run for office themselves. They can support candidates on the federal level who are advocating for the Equality Act, which is a piece of legislation that has been introduced in Congress that would amend the 1964 Civil Rights Act to include protections for LGBTQ people at the legislative level. We know that silence is tacit endorsement, and the best way to combat these anti-equality efforts is to move the needle forward on pro-equality initiatives and efforts.
Well said, Michael. It's really been a pleasure to chat with you today. And happy Pride Month, despite all of these regressive forces we face.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's really a privilege. I'm always happy to be here.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
the Zionist colonial settler state of Israel is not the moral legatee of the victims of the Holocaust, much less the moral legatee of the ancient prophets of the Jewish people. Never has this been more evident than last month with the exposure of the Israeli army's assassination of the beloved Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Assassination is a political murder. Shireen had covered the Israeli military's occupation of the West Bank for Al Jazeera for 25 years. The day she was killed, she was reporting on the Israeli military invasion of Jenin, an Arab town in the West Bank occupied by the Israeli army for 55 years. She was wearing a helmet and a protective vest marked Press. It is the practice of the Israeli army to shoot journalists and otherwise suppress the truth of their war crimes, including the illegal theft of Palestinian lands. Israel's brutal occupation has been going on since it illegally seized the West Bank as a prize of the 1967 war between Israel and three of its Arab neighbors. Since then, the Israeli military has ruled the native Arabs. Shireen is the 86th journalist to be killed while covering Israel's illegal occupation since 1967. The murder of Shireen was not adequately exposed by the U.S. press. The United States supports Israel politically, ideologically, economically, and morally. The U.S. gives the State of Israel more than $3.8 billion a year in weapons. Shireen was killed by a high-velocity, armor-piercing 5.56-millimeter bullet fired from a Ruger Mini 14 semi-automatic rifle. The weapon was made in the USA. Israel has refused to conduct an investigation of Shireen's assassination because it, quote, would provoke opposition and controversy within the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, and in Israeli society in general, end quote, according to the Israeli government. Although complaints have been filed in the International Criminal Court against Israel, the court does not appear to have the political will to thoroughly investigate those charges. There's an apocryphal story of three rabbis dispatched from a Zionist Congress in Vienna many years ago to report back on the situation in Palestine. They reported back that the bride is beautiful, but she's married to another man. The claim of the Zionists is that Israel was built on a land without a people, for a people without a land. This is Israeli propaganda. This propaganda is less and less swallowed by the new generations in the United States and Europe as they witness Israel taking over more and more of historic Palestine and attempting to prevent the truth of what they are doing from coming out. It is no longer swallowed by many Israeli scholars who have left their country to work in the United States or England. Here to discuss the assassination of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh is returning guest Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi. He is a Palestinian-American historian of the Middle East, the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University, and director of the Middle East Institute of Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. He was educated at Yale and Oxford universities and is the author of many books on the Middle East. His latest is The Hundred Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. Professor Rashid Khalidi, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Rashid, you've said that Israel's colonial army has systematically targeted Palestinian journalists. Please explain why.
Well, I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. In the last 22 years, I think, 46 Palestinian journalists have been killed, and since the occupation began, over 80, that is to say, in the past 55 years. During its attack on Gaza last spring in May, Israel destroyed the building in which AP and Al Jazeera had their headquarters. All of the journalists there were Palestinian. Fortunately, none of them were killed, but the destruction of a building with news organizations in it is an indication of how important it is to Israel to shoot the messenger, sometimes literally killing the messenger, as in the case of Shireen Abu Akleh, unfortunately many others. But generally speaking, targeting journalists, harassing journalists. The BBC had journalists beaten up the other day during the so-called flag march, I think a week ago Sunday. And that's par for the course. The messenger reveals the horrors of an occupation that's gone on for 55 years and of a colonial system that's been there for many, many decades more. The easiest way to stop those pictures and those images and words about them from getting out is to attack the messenger. It's a tried and true method. In addition, of course, to bullying editors and journalists.
Thanks, Rashid. Shireen Abu Akleh was covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp when she was assassinated. Why do you think Israel targeted her there? Why is Jenin an iconic symbol?
Well, Jenin was the site of one of the most ferocious battles that was fought during the Second Intifada in 2002. Israel attacked the refugee camp there in particular. The whole area has been a hotbed of resistance, the whole Jenin area, but the refugee camp adjacent to the town of Jenin, to the city of Jenin, was a particular target of the Israelis during their reoccupation of the towns and cities of the West Bank in 2002. During that battle, over 20 Israeli soldiers were killed. Double that number of Palestinians were killed, about half of whom, or a little more than half of whom, were combatants, and about half of whom were civilians. Jenin has been, as you suggested, iconic for Palestinians, but it's also a symbol of resistance that the Israelis are determined to erase, whence their constant attacks on the Jenin area. Every time anything happens, Israel unleashes its army and its security forces on Jenin, and in particular on the Jenin refugee camp, which is near where Shireen Abu Akleh was murdered.
Collective punishment is a war crime. How does Israel use collective punishment to oppress the Palestinians?
It does so in innumerable ways. One typical example is the blowing up of the houses of families when an individual from that family is alleged to have carried out an attack. This is punishment of the entire family for the act of an individual. Another example is curfews of an entire district, neighborhood, village, sometimes region, as punishment. Withdrawal of permits for movement. The Israelis control all movement in the occupied territories. And so if they withdraw the permits that allow people to circulate, they're basically under a sort of extended form of house arrest. All of these are forms of collective punishment. There are many, many others.
Rashid, why is it significant that Shireen was a Palestinian-American? How do you think the Western media response to her assassination would have differed if she had been, say, Ukrainian?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, had she been Ukrainian, the noise would never have stopped. The extraordinary difference between the way that the media heroicizes and vaunts Ukrainian resistance to Russian occupation and how it describes Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation as terrorism is an example of a hypocritical double standard in the Western media. And had, I mean, for hopefully no Ukrainian journalists will be killed, but were one to be killed, I'm sure we would see a level of hype that goes far beyond anything that had to do with the response to the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh. I would add that had she not been a Palestinian American, much of the media coverage would not have occurred. In other words, the fact that she happened to hold an American passport, I think, probably amplified the Western media coverage. It has had absolutely no impact, of course, on the United States government, which doesn't care if American citizens who happen to be Palestinians are killed. She's the second Palestinian American to be killed in the last several months. While the weapons and other material support for this occupation from the United States continues unabated. The same thing has happened with Shireen Abu Akleh. Secretary of State Blinken was aggressively questioned during the summit of the Americas in Los Angeles Thursday about why the U.S. government has done nothing. And he said, well, we're waiting for the results. It's not clear what happened. We're waiting for the results of an investigation. An American citizen being killed should provoke an American investigation, but of course that's not going to happen. The United States will defer to Israel, which will investigate itself and whitewash itself as it always does. Nobody is ever convicted for killing Palestinians, and if they do, they never serve any time in the Israeli military. It is an ironclad rule. Dozens of Palestinians have been shot down, unarmed Palestinians have been shot down in the past several weeks. Nobody's ever investigated, let alone convicted of that, by the Israeli military.
Rashid, didn't the Israeli government say that it is refusing to investigate Shireen's killing?
They did that, but they also said that they demanded to be handed over the bullet, which the Palestinian autopsy recovered from the body of Shireen Abu Hadi. And they say that they won't do anything unless the Palestinians agree to a joint investigation. And the Palestinians have rightly said that, you know, the murderer is not the person to investigate their own crime. So that's where that is. An Israeli investigation is not an investigation. So it's a joke that Blinken and the Israelis are talking about this.
Rashid, Israeli propaganda claims that Israel is a tiny island of democracy in a sea of hostile Arabs. Is this story believed by young Americans now, particularly Jewish young Americans?
I think one of the more encouraging developments in recent years is the degree to which younger people in the United States, and I think the world over, are less and less susceptible to these propaganda lines. Making the desert bloom, tiny little Israel surrounded by hordes of fanatical Arabs, and so on and so forth. I mean, we all know these tropes, which are believed implicitly by many older people in the United States and elsewhere, but which are regarded as nonsense by most younger people, or many increasing numbers, I should say, of younger people. This is true in the Jewish community. It's true everywhere else. It's true among other minorities. It's true among young people everywhere, university students and others. They are fortunate in having access to other than the mainstream corporate media, that is to say, through social media and through their access to all kinds of international sources. They know much more of the truth than the older generation ever was able to access, because you were dependent on media that were subject to extraordinary pressures, both on the ground in Palestine and in New York. When the report would come back, it would be bowdlerized, tenderized, edited, such that anything unfavorable to Israel was either eliminated or pushed down to paragraph 27. And that means that younger people have a much clearer view of reality. So these ludicrous tropes, I mean, Israel is a nuclear superpower that has bombed 8 of its neighbors. It is an aggressive expansionist state that's been in occupation since its formation, since 1967, I should say, of the entirety of the West Bank, and controls the Gaza Strip from outside, and is in occupation of the Golan Heights and of Arab East Jerusalem. Young people see that. They see what the occupation is. And this argument that a country has had a military dictatorship that rules over as many people, almost, as the population of Israel itself is a democracy, is a sham. You can't be a democracy when you have under your control a population that has absolutely no rights, that is subject to a military dictatorship in which the judge and the jury and the prosecutor are all military. There is no law in the occupied territories. There's just military rule. And there's arbitrary detention, and there's murder of people without any consequences, with complete impunity. And those ideas all go against the idea of the rule of law, which is central to any democracy. So for Israeli citizens, there is certainly democracy. For the Palestinians they rule over through a military dictatorship, through this military occupation, there is none. And young people see that. And so the hypocrisy of talking about Israel as a democratic and a Jewish state at the same time is evident, especially to younger people.
So how are charges of anti-Semitism used as an excuse to distract from criticism of the Zionist occupation of Israel?
This is a tactic that reveals the bankruptcy of advocates for Israel. They actually have no arguments about things like the occupation, about things like the apartheid nature of the Israeli regime. In particular, the fact that there are two completely different systems of law in the occupied territories. The Israeli Knesset is now struggling with passing a temporary extension of the extension of Israeli law only to Israeli Jewish citizens in the occupied territories. Palestinians are not able to access Israeli law in the occupied territories. They're subject to military dictatorship. So you have two systems of law. If that's not one of the core elements of apartheid, I don't know what is. That is an example of the kind of problem that Israel has today. It cannot sell those things. So instead of peddling these well-worn and completely unbelievable nostrums, advocates of Israel are increasingly resorting to ad hominem attacks on people who are advocating for Palestinian rights by calling them anti-Semitic. This is a travesty in terms of real existing anti-Semitism, most of which, as we know, is on the right among white nationalists who peddle something called the Great Replacement Theory, which they claim involves Jews manipulating other people to replace white people. That is anti-Semitism. That is real, deadly, murderous anti-Semitism. The advocacy for Palestinian rights, on the other hand, is simply a claim that the state of Israel, not the Jews, not the Jewish people, the state of Israel, is engaged in establishing a system of apartheid, is engaged in depriving Palestinians of their rights, and has been for decades. And there's nothing anti-Semitic, nothing whatsoever that's anti-Semitic about that. It is, I think, these accusations are a revelation of the desperation and the bankruptcy of people who are advocating for Israel. There's nothing else they can say, really. I mean, how can they claim that a 55-year-old occupation is the fault of the Palestinians, which is basically the Israeli default position? Oh, there's nobody to negotiate with, or whatever nonsense they put out.
I just wanted to add, Rashid, that Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem have all said that Israel is an apartheid state. Is there anything you wanted to add to that?
Well, I mean, I'm a historian, and I would argue for differentiating between different forms of settler colonialism and different forms of imposed inequality that those settler colonial regimes always establish. I think there are a lot of similarities between, historically speaking now, between the regime that Israel has created in the occupied territories of two systems of rights for two different groups, two different ethnic groups, and between the system established in South Africa. There are clearly some similarities. In law, as I understand it, not being a lawyer myself, it is pretty clear that Israel has met the definition in international law for apartheid. And the fact that these three human rights organizations, these three very respected human rights organizations, have come to the same conclusion would seem to validate that. As a historian, however, I would argue for enormous differences between the Israeli regime, which you can call an apartheid regime if you wish, and the original apartheid regime in South Africa. As many South Africans who suffered from apartheid have said after visiting the occupied territories, they feel that what Israel has instituted there is in many ways much worse than apartheid. But in legal terms, as I understand it, the regime that Israel has established does meet the legal definition of apartheid, which, as I say, is what these three respected groups have agreed.
And Rashid, apartheid constitutes a crime against humanity under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. 2 weeks before Shireen was assassinated, leading Palestinian journalist organizations filed a complaint in the International Criminal Court, the ICC, accusing Israel of systematically targeting Palestinian journalists, and additional complaints have been filed with the ICC stemming from Shireen's death. The Biden administration opposes an ICC investigation into her killing. Do you think the court will mount a full criminal investigation, or is U.S. pressure on the ICC too strong for any real accountability for Israel?
I mean, I wouldn't venture to predict what might happen, but I would guess that you may be right in the second part of your question, that U.S. pressure may well be too great for the ICC to proceed in this case. I think it's a tragedy that the United States is basically running interference for Israel no matter what it does. The murder of an American citizen, one might think, would rise to the level that might force this administration to actually do something to wrap Israel on the knuckles. But they are so obsessed with Israeli domestic politics, as they have been for decades. I've watched American foreign policy very closely, sometimes as a negotiator with the Israeli delegation in Washington, in the State Department. And the only thing they care about is Israeli domestic politics. How will this affect the political balance in Israel? Palestinians are run over, killed, massacred, have their rights taken away from them. That doesn't really matter to them. All that matters to them is how, I'm talking about the State Department now, how this anything might affect the stability of the given Israeli government or the Israeli domestic balance. The other thing that concerns American politicians, of course, is how it will play with lobbies in the United States, whether we're talking about the right-wing Republicans who may support Israel for reasons that have to do with their evangelical beliefs, or whether it has to do with AIPAC and other groups that support Israel. That is a concern of the politicians. The State Department obsessively focuses on the stability of Israeli governments and not wanting to disturb their Israeli friends. It's a travesty and a disgrace that American diplomacy is led by people for whom Palestinian rights are of absolutely no significance, or that the continued occupation of Palestine is of no significance, by contrast with their great concern for human rights in places like the Ukraine and with Russian occupation of the Ukraine. The Russian occupation of the Ukraine has been going on since February of this year. We're, I think, in our fourth month.
We're speaking with Professor Rashid Khalidi. Rashid, talk about the significance of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS. What is it, and how effective has it been?
Well, boycott, divestment, and sanctions grew out of a movement that developed in Palestinian civil society a number of years ago. Palestinian unions, educators, intellectuals, community leaders, women's groups, and so on, got together and said, you know, in the absence of an effective Palestinian national movement with leaderships that are not doing their job, what can we do to advance the cause of Palestine abroad? And they asked others in the rest of the world to consider the idea of boycotting Israeli government institutions, of divesting from stocks that support the Israeli occupation or the Israeli war machine, for urging their governments, people's governments, to impose sanctions on Israel for its violations of international law. I don't think that this movement has been particularly effective in terms of actually producing economically meaningful boycotts, in causing an enormous amount of divestment from Israel, or in leading to the imposition of any major sanctions. On the other hand, and this is, I think, the great importance of it, it has forced people to confront what Israel does on a daily basis to the Palestinians, on university campuses, for groups of stockholders of corporations, for various companies, and for some governments. It has forced them in Europe, in the United States, and in other parts of the world to confront the fact that they are complicit in supporting the violation of Palestinian human rights, and that whether it's companies or it's the portfolios of universities, the stock portfolios of universities, or whether it's governments. And I think in this realm, it's been extremely effective. And the proof of this is the insensate, almost violent reaction of the supporters of Israel, who mobilized all the lobbies at their disposal, all the politicians on their payroll, to pass laws to ban state governments in particular from having anything to do with people who support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Now, every time that these laws have been challenged in the courts, they have been deemed unconstitutional. They are, of course, an unconstitutional violation of people's First Amendment rights. In addition, I think it should really be said, boycott is one of the oldest tools of the oppressed against colonial oppressors. It was devised by the Irish in the 1880s against the English. It was used in India, in South Africa, in the American South. It is an iconic tool of the oppressed, which should be sacred rather than banned by law. And it is a measure of how perverse our political system is, that tame state legislatures are willing to pass these laws written for them by lobbies that are simply trying to protect Israel from any criticism. And I think that's an indication of how effective this movement has been, simply in bringing these issues up. The very fact that they're passing such laws has caused controversy that has been extremely harmful to Israel. Every time that these issues come up on campus, people are forced to debate something that Israel prefers not to be seen. That's why they shoot journalists. They don't want issues to be discussed. They can't win those arguments. How do you defend occupation? How do you defend shooting unarmed people? How do you defend babies in incubators in Jerusalem whose mothers are not allowed to visit them because they can't get a permit to cross a line and go 10 or 15 kilometers? You can't justify that stuff. unjustifiable. And therefore, we have these ludicrous charges of anti-Semitism, and we have this almost hysterical movement against BDS launched by the Israel lobby. And I think that, as I say, that's an indication of the effectiveness of this campaign.
Rashid, do you think that public opinion about the role Israel is playing in the Middle East is changing? And if so, how?
Well, I think American public opinion is changing. I think public certainly opinion within the Democratic Party is changing. Opinion among young people is changing. I'm talking about the United States here. And I think opinion, especially among young people in the Jewish community, is changing as well. On all of those fronts, there has been a sea change. You see this in campus resolutions passed on campuses which have large numbers of Jewish students and very few Muslim and Arab students. You see this within churches passing resolutions, insisting that they withdraw their investments from companies that support the Israeli occupation. And you see this finally among the very few, but nevertheless significant number of congresspeople and senators who are finally raising their heads above the parapet and questioning the unconditionality of American support for Israel. But I think that public opinion is definitely changing, at least among those constituencies, young people, some sectors, especially young people in the Jewish community. It is very clear the base of the Democratic Party, look at polling, is unequivocal, is much more sympathetic to the Palestinians than it ever was before, and much more critical of Israel than it ever was before. You don't see that reflected in President Biden or Vice President Harris or Senator Schumer or the leaders of the party in Congress, all of whom are committed supporters of Israel, no matter what it does, no matter what enormity it perpetrates. These people are supporters of Israel. But at the grassroots and among an increasing number of elected officials, this is no longer taboo. There is a clear sign that public opinion has begun to shift in a significant way, at least among those sectors of the American population.
Marjorie and I are very grateful for your good work over the years, and we're very grateful for your being on Law and Disorder. Before we come to an end, can you please tell our listeners how they can follow your work, and please mention your latest book?
I hope that they will follow my work. The best way is to read the things that I've written. I mean, I write all over the place, but most importantly, this recent book that I published, The 100 Years War on Palestine, subtitle is A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, is one way that I would suggest people follow some of the arguments that I've made and the answers that I've given to Michael and Marjorie's questions. This conflict is misframed, misinterpreted, misanalyzed in a number of ways. And the thing that I try and do in the book is to put it into its proper frame. This is a settler colonial project. Yes, it's a national project. Yes, an Israeli people has been created, and there is a national element to this. But this would not have happened but for the support of external powers. And it's a classical settler colonial process, bringing Europeans to settle in a non-European land and to dispossess the native population. This is what happened in North America. This is what happened in Australia. This is what happened in several parts of Africa, Kenya, South Africa, Algeria, and it is what has happened, or is happening, I should say, in Palestine. So I put the struggle in Palestine in that context. I give proper importance to the role of the great imperial powers, especially Britain at the outset, and more recently, the United States. And I try and do this in a way in this book which draws on my own experiences and the experiences of other people I know, people in my family and others, so that the story is told in a way that hopefully is relatable. So that's the 100 Years War on Palestine. I've written other things that I hope people will also look at.
Rashid, thank you so much for writing this book, for being our guest on Law and Disorder, and every success in the future. You take it easy.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Marjorie.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations Refugee Agency says the number of displaced people displaced from their homes worldwide has reached a
staggering new high of over 100 million. That's up from 89 million just a few months ago, due in part to Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the growing food crisis. This is UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi.
Will this also cause people to move? Now, it's very difficult to tell, but I cannot imagine how. If you have a food crisis on top of everything that I have described, right? War, human rights, climate, you name it. On top of that, you have a food crisis. It will just accelerate the trends that are described in this report and that we have seen accelerating already in the first few months of the year.
The surge in global refugees comes as parts of Africa are facing their worst drought in decades at a time when food and energy costs are soaring. The United Nations has warned 350,000 children in Somalia could die by the end of the summer. A recent report by two UN agencies estimated an all-time high of up to 49 million people in 46 countries could now be at risk of falling into famine or famine-like conditions. Earlier this week, Congressmember Ilhan Omar, who is a Somali refugee, tweeted, "This should be the biggest story in the world right now." The leaders of Germany, France, and Italy have arrived in Ukraine to meet with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. During a stop in the Ukrainian city of Irpin, French President Emmanuel Macron criticized what he called Russian barbarism. Ahead of the trip, Macron repeated his call for Ukraine and Russia to hold talks to end the war.
Because at some point when we have helped as much as possible to resist, and I hope Ukraine will have won, and above all for the fighting to have stopped, we will have to negotiate. The Ukrainian president and his officials will have to negotiate with Russia, and we, Europeans, will be at the table bringing up the guarantees of security, the elements which concern our continent, and that is the reality of things.
On Wednesday, Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke by phone with Russian President Vladimir Putin in the second known call between the two leaders since the war began. Xi reportedly expressed support for Russia's, quote, sovereignty and security and pledged to increase ties with Moscow. He's also said to have called on all parties to push for a, quote, proper settlement of the Ukraine crisis. Also on Wednesday, NATO defense leaders met in Brussels and pledged to increase military support for Ukraine. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin announced a new $1 billion U.S. military package. The NATO meeting came as heavy fighting continues in eastern Ukraine. The United Nations is warning 10,000 civilians trapped in the Ukrainian city of Severodonetsk are running out of essential supplies. Russia seized about 80% of the city. Meanwhile, Ukrainian forces have reportedly shelled a maternity ward and four other health facilities in Donetsk, an area controlled by Russia. According to the United Nations, no one was killed or injured in the maternity ward attack, but some pregnant women had to be transferred to other hospitals. In other news from Ukraine, two U.S. veterans who volunteered to fight with Ukraine have been missing since June 9th. This, according to their families. The State Department has not confirmed the reports. Brazilian authorities say a suspect has confessed to killing and dismembering British journalist Dom Phillips and the Brazilian indigenous expert Bruno Araujo Pereira. Brazilian police said the suspect led them to a spot where human remains were found. In a statement, a local indigenous group condemned the murders and praised the work of Phillips and Pereira, saying, quote, they were both human rights defenders and died doing work to look after us indigenous people. Days before Pereira went missing, he reportedly received threats for his efforts to stop illegal fishing in the area. The two suspects arrested so far are brothers who fish for a living. A number of new revelations have come to light about Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election and the January 6th insurrection. On Wednesday, the January 6th House Select Committee released video evidence that Republican Congressmember Barry Loudermilk gave a private tour of the Capitol to a group of people on January 5th, one day before the insurrection. At the time, the Capitol was closed to the public due to the pandemic. In the video, one man on the tour is seen photographing stairways, tunnels, hallways, and security checkpoints. The committee also released what it says is video from January 6th from outside the Capitol of one of the men who is on the tour with South Carolina Congressmember Loudermilk.
There's no escape, Pelosi, Schumer, Nadler. We're coming for you. We're coming in like white on rice for Pelosi, Nadler, Schumer, even you, AOC. We're coming to take you out. We'll pull you out by your hairs. How about that, Pelosi? Go, might as well make yourself another appointment. I'll get done with you. You're going to need a shine up on top of that bald head.
Correction, on the tour that was held the day before, it was conducted by Georgia Congressman Loudermilk. The January 6th committee is holding its third public hearing today, beginning at 1 p.m. Eastern. Democracy Now! Will live stream it at democracynow.org. The hearing is focusing on Donald Trump's efforts to pressure Mike Pence to block Joe Biden from becoming president. Part of that effort was led by Trump legal advisor John Eastman, who claimed Pence could single-handedly overturn the election. In related news, The Washington Post reporting Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, exchanged emails with Eastman about the election. Meanwhile, The New York Times reports Eastman appeared to have inside knowledge of a debate within the Supreme Court over how it should handle Trump's election fraud claims. In an email sent in late December 2020, Eastman wrote, quote, "I understand that there's a heated fight underway." Another pro-Trump lawyer responded, writing that the, quote, "odds of action before January 6th will become more favorable if the justices start to fear that there will be wild chaos on January 6th unless they rule by then either way." John Eastman is a former law clerk of Justice Clarence Thomas. In more news on the January 6th insurrection, new court filings show the leader of the far-right Proud Boys received plans to occupy six congressional office buildings as well as the Supreme Court around the time of January 6th. The document was titled 1776 Returns. One section of the report was named Storm the Winter Palace. Part of the document reads, quote, "No Trump, no America." New Mexico's state Supreme Court has ordered a Republican-led county commission to certify the results of the June 7th primary. The commission has refused to do so, citing conspiracy theories about the county's voting machines, which were made by Dominion, the company at the heart of many of Trump's false claims about the 2020 election. One member of the Otero County Commission is Coy Griffin, who co-founded the group Cowboys for Trump and once said, "the only good Democrat is a dead Democrat." Griffin faces sentencing on Friday for his role in the January 6th insurrection. The standoff in New Mexico comes as voting rights activists are expressing increasing alarm as supporters of Trump's attempted coup take control of more local election bodies around the country. An advisory panel to the Food and Drug Administration has unanimously recommended approval of Pfizer and Moderna's vaccines for babies and young children. The FDA could authorize the vaccines as soon as Friday, which means shots could be available beginning next week for the first time for children under the age of five. States have already ordered millions of shots, but there has been one exception. Florida has not yet pre-ordered any COVID shots for kids. In other COVID news, the National Institutes of Health has announced Dr. Anthony Fauci has tested positive for COVID-19. The 81-year-old doctor is reportedly experiencing mild symptoms. In Geneva, public health activists staged a die-in protest at the World Trade Organization summit Wednesday. They were calling on nations to embrace a broad waiver on intellectual property rules to save lives during the COVID pandemic. In economic news, the Federal Reserve has increased interest rates by 0.75 percentage point in an attempt to combat rising inflation. It's the largest rate hike since 1994. The rate hike will make it more expensive for people to borrow for homes, cars, and get other loans. The Justice Department has filed federal hate crimes charges against the 18-year-old white supremacist gunman who shot dead 10 black people at a Buffalo supermarket last month. If convicted, Peyton Gendron could be sentenced to the death penalty, even though the Biden administration's imposed a moratorium on federal executions. Attorney General Merrick Garland spoke Wednesday.
The affidavit in support of the complaint quotes the defendant as stating that his goal was to, quote, kill as many blacks as possible. The affidavit outlines how the defendant prepared for months to carry out this attack. It alleges that he selected a target in this zip code because it has the highest percentage of black people close enough to where he lives.
The attorney general was speaking in Buffalo. And in Washington, D.C., the street outside the Saudi embassy has been officially renamed Jamal Khashoggi Way to honor the Washington Post columnist who was dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul almost 4 years ago. The D.C. City Council approved the name change last year. A street naming ceremony was held Wednesday, just weeks before President Biden's scheduled to visit Saudi Arabia in an effort to mend ties with the oil-rich kingdom. The Yemeni-born Nobel Peace Prize winner, Tawakkol Karman, spoke at the ceremony in D.C. and criticized Biden's trip.
This means that Biden has abandoned his commitment to support human rights around the world, that Biden has abandoned his commitment to banish Jamal Khashoggi's killer, that Biden has abandoned his promises to his people that he will be hand with hand with the all freedom fighters around the world. And this is shame. It is shame. Shame on Biden administration.
Tawakkol Karman won the Nobel Peace Prize. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
And welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. If you're on Twitter, we're on Twitter handle TheTaxCast. If you want to make sure you never miss a TaxCast, email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Okay, so we're hearing a lot from world leaders about sanctions against Russian oligarchs at the moment. We know financial secrecy is what the powerful, the corrupt and criminals really love. With financial secrecy, they can undermine the democratic will of any country's government. They can drain the tax revenues that stop the rest of us living secure and happy lives. So, Which nations are the world's worst offenders when it comes to financial secrecy? I'm going to tell you, because this month, the Tax Justice Networks released the latest results of the Financial Secrecy Index 2022. Our specialist team ranks countries every 2 years on how secretive their financial and legal systems are. Then they combine that with how big a financial secrecy global player they are. In other words, how much damage they're doing in the world. So, what this isn't is a list of the world's most secretive jurisdictions, as is sometimes misreported. This is a list of countries ranked according to the level of secrecy services a country offers customers, combined with its size as a global player. I'll give you an example. The very beautiful Maldives is a highly secretive jurisdiction, but it's a really small player globally, so it doesn't have a significant impact on global financial secrecy, so it's not at the top of the index. So it's logical, isn't it, that the bigger a financial secrecy supplier a nation is, the more responsibility they have to reduce their secrecy services because they're doing more damage. So this is a ranking you don't want to be at the top of. Here's the top 10. Our 2022 Roll Call of Shame. At number one is the United States, with the worst rating ever recorded by the Financial Secrecy Index. Number two is Switzerland. Joining the top three for the first time is Singapore. Number four, Hong Kong. Number five, Luxembourg. Number six is Japan, which increased its supply of financial secrecy to the world by 10%. Germany's shot up to number 7 from 14th place last time. It's increased its secrecy supply by a third. A very bad result for them. So much for all that cheap talk on sanctions on oligarchs. And at number 8, the United Arab Emirates. At least they don't pretend to care about oligarchs. Number 9, the British Virgin Islands, a British overseas territory. And number 10, Guernsey, a British Crown Dependency. God save the Queen! The fascist regime! And yes, don't be fooled by the United Kingdom not being in the top 10. This time, the UK is at the number 13 spot. But, as is always the case, I'm ashamed as a British person to tell you that when you combine Britain with all its satellite havens around the world, it is still the world's worst offender. We're going to talk about Britain later, and of course the shockingly bad result for the United States, and how other G7 states, Japan, Germany and Italy, are holding back progress. By the way, when it comes to China, it's zoomed up to number 11 in the index. And what China does is extremely impactful on, for example, Africa, since China's their biggest trading partner. Anyway, there are 141 countries assessed in the index, so there's plenty more fascinating stuff there. I asked head of the Tax Justice Network, Alex Cobham, for his reaction to the 2022 Financial Secrecy Index results.
I guess the least surprising thing was the US actually getting to the top as the biggest global threat. But the kind of the backsliding of the G7 was a bit unexpected. I hadn't thought we'd see that across that set of the most powerful countries. But the biggest surprise was Cayman. Cayman has dropped from the top out of the top 10. And surprising because of the reason for it. You know, they've spent so long. I think Cayman Finance has put more money and more time than anyone in the world into criticising the index. And The index rightly judges them as highly secretive. To be fair, they have genuinely improved this year. Their secrecy score is down from 76 to 72, mainly because the UK required it to join the UN conventions on terrorist financing and the Convention Against Corruption. But the reason the rank has dropped so sharply is because all of this time they've been refusing to publish the information about their share of international financial services exports, and now they've finally done it. And it's revealed that their global role is actually much smaller than we and pretty much everybody else had always estimated from the data that they do actually allow to become public. Now, what that means is that they must have known all of this time that their ranking in the index was seriously overinflated. And I suppose they took the decision that they'd rather look like they were the really, really bad guys than actually come clean and tell people that they're not quite such a big player in global finance as they were allowing people to think. So that's the big surprise. Of course, you know, the UK and its set of dependent territories remains the biggest overall problem, despite Cayman's improvements.
That's interesting. I mean, when it comes to the G7 nations, the Financial Secrecy Index points a finger really, really strongly at the US, the UK, Japan, Germany and Italy. And, you know, they have been shouting the loudest about sanctions on Russian oligarchs. Yet we now know through the Financial Secrecy Index results that they're responsible for cutting back progress on the financial transparency that would have allowed sanctions to happen. I mean, complete hypocrisy. What is going on with that?
It's kind of fascinating, isn't it? This set of countries, these are not the most secretive jurisdictions in the world, not by a long shot. But they are big players, and so their secrecy matters. They have a big share of global financial services, and so when they are more secretive, it poses a bigger risk to everyone else. As you say, what's happened this year is that the progress that would have been made if the G7 had just stood still has been cut by more than half, because actually they've gone backwards. Then Canada and France, to round out the G7, actually both getting slightly better, so well done them. Showing, you know, it can be done, including within the EU, but it takes a bit of commitment. So it's a slightly depressing picture. You know, these are the countries, as you say, in this moment of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that are looking to make sanctions effective, and they need to be looking at themselves and saying, the way that we deny progress on financial transparency doesn't just deny the ability of other countries to tax fairly and to act against corruption, it also denies our own ability to impose effective sanctions if we want to. You have to hope that if there's a silver lining to any of that, it's a recognition, including among these most powerful countries, that allowing anonymous wealth is undermining for all of us, and we just have to finally push through and deliver on the beneficial ownership transparency, knowing who is buying companies, trusts, foundations, partnerships and bank accounts, so that we can all be broadly confident that law and order is applied across the board and that the system works and that we can tax progressively.
Yeah, and another trend which, I mean, tell me if I'm right or not in suspecting that when it comes to autocratic states, there's a sort of a rise in the use of those states for financial secrecy, and surely oligarchs worldwide will be observing all this talk about sanctions against prominent Russians. Now, we've seen in this index, very interestingly, the rise of the United Arab Emirates. Singapore has risen a lot too, which I know it's a democracy, but it's also described by many as a thinly veiled autocracy. Hong Kong also. Could this be a future trend in your view, and what would that mean?
I think it's definitely crystallising as a trend. And remembering that the index is, in a sense, backward-looking because it takes a long time to bring together the data, the trends we're actually seeing this year aren't yet reflected in the index. And so it's already going to go further than what we're seeing in the index now. And I think the way you frame it is spot on. We're seeing a shift which I think we can probably think is broadly positive, but with some caution. It's a shift away from the secrecy jurisdictions, the tax havens that have sold themselves as offering good governance, tax-neutral investment platforms for the concerned international investor, right? Where the key thing, in a sense, is that you're saying, you know, if you have a dispute, our legal systems are absolutely straight and you'll be appropriately protected. Your property rights will be protected. Now, you may be doing all sorts of bad things elsewhere, but not to worry, we'll look after you. What we're seeing now, as you say, is a shift towards a set of jurisdictions that really don't make those claims about good governance, or at least not with any seriousness, because, you know, the common thread, Hong Kong, Singapore, the United Arab Emirates, is a pretty much complete disregard for human rights. They may still claim that they've got systems in place to protect investors, but not as human beings, only as, you know, the sources of money. And I think the fact that we're seeing that shift, we're seeing secrecy services increasingly going to that sort of jurisdiction, is a positive sign in that it reflects a kind of marginalization of illicit financial flows. It's no longer something that you can just do through London or Delaware. And, you know, this is good business practice and everyone says, oh, that's probably okay. Increasingly, we're seeing people, not least Russian oligarchs, in effect, being openly in defiance of the application of laws or sanctions that others try to put on them, and going to these places where most other people are denied full human rights as a choice. So this is not something you can defend as good governance or investment practice or anything else. This is clearly nothing more than an attempt to defy others making their own laws effective or new. And you're so keen to do that that you're willing to hold your nose about whatever other practices that jurisdiction has. So I don't think you could say, you know, this is anything like the end of the road, but I think we'll look back in a few years and this might seem like a bit of a turning point when that kind of good governance, investor protection argument for secrecy jurisdictions was finally nailed. And it became clear that, you know, this is about hiding and cheating and dodging and abusing and nothing else. And if you want to do it, well, you do it over there and the rest of us will make our own judgments about you. But let nobody pretend this is good investor behaviour or anything of the sort.
That's really interesting. And I mean, we shouldn't be that surprised because in the end, you know, tax havens and secrecy jurisdictions are fundamentally anti-democratic. The G7's going to have to up its game, you know, a lot. And that's what we are getting strong and clear from the secrecy index, isn't it? I mean, together some of those nations, they've increased their supplies of financial secrecy. Italy and Germany by a third, Japan by 10%, the UK by 2%. The US, well, that's the worst rating ever recorded since the ranking began in 2009.
Yeah. Look, it's, you know, it's an interesting time to see whether or the extent to which the financial sector, broadly defined, takes heed of what's going on. So, you know, I was looking at earlier this year, thinking about the British Virgin Islands. So here's a jurisdiction, a UK dependency, under investigation by the UK, and that takes a lot, you know, for the depth of its corruption. And the question you're asking yourself is, like, this is a major provider of anonymous companies used by investors of some description all around the world, and a certain number of major multinationals and financial services firms too. Are those firms, those kind of mainstream responsible financial actors, are they going to stay in the BVI, or are they going to say no? And, you know, and now that the UK has confirmed in its findings the depth of the corruption, what's their decision? Do you say, okay, we can't be there, it's just, it's so obvious that we're just there to cheat people and, you know, there can't be any kind of good governance argument or anything? Or do you say, look, we don't care, we need the secrecy, we need the ability to cheat, so we're going to stay anyway and we'll take a bit of a reputational hit? But now there's a lot more of the financial services actors around the world finding that they're in places that are really increasingly going to be seen or are seen as kind of beyond the pale. So what do you do? I think we're going to see a bit of a separation. And, you know, it's, I guess, the tide going out to some extent. We'll see who's naked. You know, we'll see who really needs the secrecy, regardless of the reputational damage, and who has some kind of slightly more genuine commitment to responsible financial services practice.
Yes, the secrecy space is being squeezed, and the index team did identify a 5% global reduction in financial secrecy, although the increases in the G7 nations I mentioned really cuts that progress right back. But let's look at the number one global offender, the United States. Wow. I mean, after all the Biden administration has said about tackling tax havens and about sanctioning oligarchs, I mean, they've increased their financial secrecy supply to the world by almost a third, the largest supply ever recorded by the index. That's despite some fantastic anti-corruption coalitions in the States and achievements like the passing of the Corporate Transparency Act, finally passed after so many years of trying. I spoke to Ryan Garuli of the FACT Coalition in the United States about the result for his country.
I think that there are a lot of different factors that contribute to the score. The score itself is not surprising. There are a couple of different factors that contribute to it and things that we've seen as well. First and foremost, the U.S. is behind in implementing transparency-based reforms, and we know this. In fact, the U.S., which kind of kicked off the whole global transparency movement with FACA, which is the U.S. foreign account transparency mechanism, in which U.S. financial accounts held offshore are reported back to the U.S., that system is not reciprocal at all.
He means that while the United States insists on other countries sharing information on their citizens abroad, it doesn't return the favor. So information on the citizens of the world's activities in the United States remain locked in secrecy. Yes, really.
And in the meantime, after the U.S. kind of created that system, it failed to engage with the world in making a more reciprocal information exchange system in tax, and it failed to keep up in other transparency reforms related to beneficial ownership of entities, real estate, private investment funds, and regulating the enablers that help potentially corrupt actors access the extremely enticing U.S. financial system. And it's enticing for a variety of reasons. The U.S. financial system has very strong legal protection, and it offers anonymity and complete secrecy. I think it's a bit of a wake-up call, especially in light of what's happening in the world. Right now, we've seen Russia invade Ukraine. We're talking about an authoritarian nation invading a democratic country. And what we're seeing when the United States is leading, along with our allies, a global response in sanctioning the oligarchs that are part of Putin's cadre, difficult to do that if you don't know where those oligarchs are keeping their money and hiding it. And from that perspective, I think that the Western countries are recognizing that they've been playing a significant role in entrenching and empowering those regimes by allowing kleptocrats to pilfer from their own country and move that money back to secure, secretive Western jurisdictions like U.S. markets that are very attractive, and to do so on a completely anonymous basis. That has only entrenched the power at home, emboldened their actions, and is resulting in a lot of the global conflict that we're seeing. So I think that wake-up call, along with this score, will be a real call to act.
There are chinks of light, though, despite this disastrous scoring for the United States. And that might not come into view until the next Financial Secrecy Index in 2024. I mean, you've had the Corporate Transparency Act finally passed after so many years of trying. Once that's fully implemented, there should be some serious progress that should filter into the next results.
Yeah, the United States has begun to act. And the Corporate Transparency Act was passed in January of 2021. And for the first time, that will require the disclosure of beneficial ownership of most legal entities in the United States. corporations, limited liability companies, we expect it to cover every limited partnership, but we are waiting on finalized regs to confirm as much. However, there are a couple of things that are holding that up, especially as it relates to this score. For one thing, that bill hasn't been implemented. The Corporate Transparency Act passed in January 2021, but there's a tremendous amount of regulatory work to stand up the rules around that statute and the framework itself, as well as to stand up the infrastructure from a tech and digital information perspective to make sure that the law works as intended. But at the same time, the U.S. regulatory agency responsible for setting those rules up and that infrastructure up is horribly underfunded, and they're being pulled in a lot of different directions. And that's the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network at the Treasury Department, FinCEN. They've been called into action in connection with the aggression towards Ukraine in helping coordinate international sanctions, including to discover who actually owns these entities. But it would be a lot easier to do that if these structural reforms had been in place a long time ago. The last thing I'll say is the president, he has emphasized these things. He's actually identified a lot of core tenets that would both address the financial secrecy index score, but more importantly, actually create a more transparent regulatory environment in the U.S. that would not only help to enforce sanctions, but also to help prevent the need for sanctions in the future, because it would undermine the abuse of Western financial systems by kleptocrats. Those reforms include standing up and implementing the Corporate Transparency Act, bringing greater transparency to U.S. real estate markets on a nationwide permanent basis with respect to commercial and residential real estate, regulating the enablers who bring and shelter assets within our financial system, bringing transparency to private investment funds, an $11 trillion industry in the United States that has no know-your-customer or beneficial ownership rules, which is shocking. That would be the third largest economy in the world, and it's a black hole of secrecy. And finally, covering other areas that have been developing and that are of concern, including relating to luxury assets, bringing transparency to art, antiquities, and digital assets, making sure that those, you know, emerging categories of harms from a money laundering perspective are pulled into the traditional anti-money laundering frameworks. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. We just need to make sure that they're covered. You know, right now, the U.S. is itself a tax haven. It's one of the biggest secrecy jurisdictions in the world. These results confirm that. And it's no longer time for the U.S. to pretend that it can enact and create a less corrupt global environment and foster democracy without looking internally and cleaning up its own house and catching up with global norms, making sure that its rhetoric is more than just talk. It's time to walk the walk.
Ryan Garule of the FACT Coalition. Okay, let's talk about the UK. As I've said, combined with all its satellite havens, it's still the worst offender, even though, taken alone, it's ranked number 13. Unlike the United States, though, there aren't any encouraging signs. Alex Cobham again of the Tax Justice Network.
You can say that Britain is eating itself. You know, it's slightly sad. You know, we're sitting here as two Brits. You know, on the one hand, look, I think the world is increasingly aware that the UK is the biggest driver of financial secrecy, of tax havenry. The UK is the UK, and I think let's come back to the next index and see where the UK is. The UK government at present is absolutely not committed to transparency in almost any dimension, whether that's freedom of information requests from journalists or the public, or it's transparency about public procurement and public contracts, or indeed a great many other things, including financial secrecy. They haven't delivered. In fact, they've U-turned on a set of commitments that the predecessor, but still conservative, government made, including around country-by-country reporting, and the UK's corruption is becoming both more pervasive and more visible, which is what you'd expect with a country that sits at the centre of this spider's web of secrecy. We know financial secrecy corrodes, and it corrodes in the secrecy jurisdiction as much as it does damage to others. The UK is responsible for very serious revenue losses for other countries, but it also suffers very serious revenue losses itself. It is increasingly finding it difficult to make progressive taxation effective, because the tolerance of anonymous wealth and opaque corporate accounting is so high and it's so embedded politically that we don't regulate this stuff properly. And even if we pass the laws, we don't enforce them. The cost now to the British society is becoming increasingly clear. I think, you know, there will be a moment in UK politics when people say, we have to try something else.
Yeah. It's like a lost nation at the moment, a pariah nation even. And there's this ongoing race to the bottom happening between New York and London, which you can also throw into the mix. But speaking about how to tackle long-term these problems, I mean, the Tax Justice Network and other anti-corruption campaigners want a global asset registry and a United Nations tax convention. I know these are big subjects, but can you briefly explain how the global asset registry would work practically?
Sure. So, you know, we already have registries of a lot of assets. You know, so a lot of countries have a land registry that records, depending either the legal owner or ideally the ultimate warm-blooded beneficial owner. And then a lot of countries have that for companies, and an increasing number of countries have that for trusts and foundations as well. Then if you look at kind of high-value assets like yachts and private aircraft, you often have registers, sometimes international, of who the owners are. And then even thinking about works of art in some cases, and other assets, we see similar types of registers. Now, not all of them are perfect. Not all of them identify the beneficial owner or don't do it entirely effectively. But there's a lot of information there. Most of it public, some of it held privately, that could be joined up. And that's really what a global asset registry is. The idea that you could actually put together the company ownership register for all jurisdictions, and then the same for other types of assets, other types of legal vehicles. And you'd end up with an overall structure that, let's say, law enforcement would be able, imagine, for example, that you wanted to sanction some very rich oligarch or, you know, some major criminal. You could look through the global asset registry and effectively see every element of their ownership, every structure, and every ultimate asset. And that would allow you equally to do things like taxing wealth effectively if you wanted to. Not all of the information would be in the public domain, as it's not now. Some of it would be private. Certainly, I don't think anyone's saying you should have information about people's financial accounts in the public domain. But where you've created a legal vehicle to do business, then that's, I think, generally held should be a factor of public information. So you'd have both public and private elements, and it would basically be a tool for different types of law enforcement, also civil society, journalists, and so on, for all of us to understand, really, the distribution of wealth in our countries and internationally, and if we wanted, to decide to tax it, or at least, if we're not going to tax it, to make that decision actively and with the power to do so, and be choosing democratically not to, if that's a choice that's made. So it's really about empowering people, both to make sure that laws and taxes are applied fairly, but also to allow us to curtail inequalities.
Okay, and the United Nations Tax Convention, so important to enshrine tax rights in a legally enforceable way to protect citizens. That's another longer term thing we'd like to see happen, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not so sure it's long term anymore. I think we've had a shift. There's been a sense that, you know, the OECD has actually had 10 years on corporate tax and it's failed. You know, nobody, including the big OECD members, nobody is happy with what the OECD's put on the table after 10 years of trying. That's on the corporate tax side. Meanwhile, on the transparency side, you know, we have the Financial Action Task Force, whose former long-standing head has just come out and, you know, really ripped them apart and highlighted just how much they have failed to achieve things like beneficial ownership, transparency, among more than a, you know, handful of members, and how actually there's a small group of major members who really control it and stop it delivering high standards for everyone. We know the UN Tax Committee already has kind of delivered on digital taxation in a way that the OECD is failing. It's kind of obvious that this stuff should be done at the UN. My feeling is we might see negotiations on a convention begin within a year. It really feels we could be that close. And there's still a long way to go even if we get started. But I think there's just this general sense that the architecture doesn't work. It doesn't work for lower income countries, in fact it never has done. But even for OECD members, I think there's a frustration that they're not getting the kind of effective changes that they need. And something like the failure of the G7 to be able to make sanctions effective in the case of Russia, because of their own failure to be transparent, I think is shifting the dial on what might be acceptable as global standards. So I feel pretty positive at the minute. I think it's not such a long-term ambition after all.
And very interestingly, the African Union has just passed a resolution calling on the United Nations for a tax convention. Alex, I'm cheered to see that the Financial Secrecy Index 2022 finds that global financial secrecy actually shrank by 5%, so it is going down. But once you factor in the G7 countries I mentioned earlier, them increasing their secrecy services by so much, it's whittled down that global percentage to 2%. But it is still an ongoing reduction, which is encouraging, even though in the last index it was down by 7%. I know that enforcement is a whole other thing, a whole other question, but the secrecy space is being squeezed, and that's a very important ongoing shift, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You could say the continuing improvement in global transparency is really a reflection of the kind of the normalization of the tax justice policy platform. There is much more automatic exchange of information about financial accounts. There is much more transparency of beneficial ownership. And there is continuing progress towards country-by-country reporting being transparent. There's a lot of progress being made, so we should feel pretty positive. Stuff is being delivered in legislation, but it's also being delivered in practice. The fact that the G7 as a group is dragging the needle back the wrong way is a definite cause for concern. But that global trajectory is positive, and it feels like the momentum will continue.
The Financial Secrecy Index 2022. I've given you just some of the highlights here. There's so much more to discover, and there's 141 countries in the index. So find out about your country on www.ssi.taxjustice.net. That's it for now from the TaxCast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next month. Bye for now.
Fathers have never met the mothers when they start taking their bottoms out and slamming into them.